You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
I'm very excited to say that today on LawPod UK, I have with me Gráinne de Bárcha, professor at NYU, who should be well known to many of our listeners as the author, with Paul Craig, of EU Law, Text, Cases and Materials, which is the book that many, if not most of us, will remember from our university days as explaining the joy that is EU law. Gráinne, you are very welcome to the podcast. And I first wanted to ask, when you were writing the first edition of this book, which was originally published all the way back in 1998, did you think it would become the resource that so many of us remember from university?
Hi, Emma. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to join you. It's great to be here. And to kick off with the EU question, the short answer is no. We had no idea. I remember it was Paul who had the original idea for a book that would combine text with cases and materials, because there wasn't a book of that kind dealing with EU law at the time. And so we thought it would just join some of the classics in the field that already existed, Wyatt and Dashwood and Foster, Steiner and a number of others. So no, we were as surprised as anyone when it was taken up so widely. I will say that there are many, many other excellent books of that kind there now, so I doubt whether we're quite as dominant as we once were.
Very modest of you, but I certainly remember that being, I mean, it's kind of desperate to say that it was a bugbear once exams came round, but I do have fond memories of the subject. But today I have you on the podcast to discuss your most recent book, Reframing Human Rights in a Turbulent Era, which I have really enjoyed reading and at various points paused and thought, my God, I wish I was this articulate myself. In particular, I loved the bit in the foreword that gives a background to the reasons why you decided to write this book. But could you just describe for listeners why you decided to write this book?
There are actually two reasons there. One is probably the more scholarly one, and the other, you might call it more political. But I think the two kind of come together in a way. So the scholarly reason was just a curiosity I had about, the simple way of describing it is, how international human rights law works. What I mean by that is there was a literature amongst political scientists saying international human rights law makes no difference, or does it? Because how could these treaties signed by states really make a difference, improve things on the ground? And there was quite a debate amongst them as to whether really they made any difference or not. And there were studies done which mapped out empirically whether things improved on the ground in particular states after their government signed on to human rights treaties. And some of these studies said no difference at all, or things get worse. And others said, no, things get better. And eventually they sort of settled on a kind of a consensus position where, well, if there's a reasonably free civil society, then signing on to an international human rights treaty seems to correlate with improvements in human rights. So I kind of thought, wow, that's really interesting. But why don't we look more closely, or I'd like to look more closely, at what it is about having an active civil society and having international human rights law that really seems to work, to put it like that. So that was the first sort of scholarly inspiration. But then it became, in more recent years, I became aware of this chorus of negative and critical voices really challenging whether the human rights movement and human rights law was really adequate, sufficient, up to the task to meet today's challenges. And there's always been a critical literature on human rights. That's a very positive thing. It keeps everyone on their toes and points out the flaws and the problems and so on. But this was different. This kind of chorus of voices was almost sort of existential, saying, This movement is over. The titles of the books were The End Time of Human Rights, Not Enough, and Twilight of Human Rights. And I felt frustrated because I thought, I don't sense that. I'm not a practitioner, but I know some of the community of human rights practice. And my sense of what was going on in the world didn't match this deep, deep pessimism and negativity. And also the kind of exhortation to forget about it, move aside, find something else if you're interested in social justice.
I mean, I certainly remember reading The Dark Side of Virtue by David Kennedy when I took one of his classes quite a long time ago now. And that was the first time I'd really come across a breaking down of why, in fact, these treaties are not effective. And we tell each other sort of stories about their effectiveness, whether or not that can be empirically proven. One of the interesting things that you talk about in your book is that increasingly these criticisms are coming from the political left rather than where you might expect criticism of human rights to come from. Is there a reason for that? Have you found in the course of your research anything that points to why that phenomenon exists?
Yeah, I think part of it is related to the more general sort of sense of turmoil on the left and concern really with liberal democracy more generally, maybe since the financial crisis, the sense that we had faith in these institutions, in these ideas as being oriented towards justice and fairness and so on. But look where we are: rising inequality, dramatic disimprovement in people's socioeconomic conditions, the runaway wealth of the 1% and so on. So that, I think that's part of it. Part of it is a sort of a sense in which maybe particularly writers like Sam Moyne, who are challenging the inability of human rights to cope with neoliberalism and distributive injustice and so on. So that's one part of it, I think. And we see challenges to the ideas of democracy across the left in other places too. Liberal democracy hasn't served us. But there's also, I think, more generally, I think, the state of turmoil of the world and the sense that, well, human rights and the human rights movement, for all its, you know, the fact that it seemed to have spread and become settled and consensus had built up around it, hasn't really managed to spread. It's unattractive to so much of the world. These other models of political systems and government are rising and beating, you know, out the Western system. So there's a sort of a more general sort of disenchantment, disillusionment, and sense of failure, I think, about the human rights movement.
What I loved in the foreword to the book was your response to critics who argue that human rights are not enough. And you say that any political system, whether capitalist, socialist, or otherwise, without the kind of moral and institutional underpinning provided by a human rights framework, with its explicit set of commitments to human dignity, freedom, and welfare, is less likely to promote a just society. You say every political system, democratic as well as authoritarian, capitalist as well as socialist, at various times and to various degrees, neglects, marginalizes, and represses parts of its population. I just thought that was so beautifully put. But in your book, you focus on three particular parts of the world. So you look at, in detail, campaigns in Ireland, Argentina, and Pakistan. And I was wondering what led you to choose those particular parts of the world?
I'm going to begin with an answer that's more general than responding to your specific question, which is that as soon as you've written a book or an article or anything else, you immediately have a massive agenda of things you should have dealt with and didn't. And this book is no exception. In retrospect, I would have done other studies, other parts of the world, other types of rights, more of a focus on core socioeconomic rights and so on. But I always think, well, that's for the next iteration or for another time. But some of the reasons are thought through, some are more contingent. Let me just address the parts of the world issue. I just wanted a geographic spread. I didn't want these all to be, you know, in Europe, which is the area I know about and come from and so on. So I chose one from Latin America, one from Asia, and then Ireland, which is the country I know best, as they say. And I was also just fascinated with what had happened in Ireland. So that was a kind of an easy and obvious choice for me. But I did look at many other countries and other possible studies. And for pragmatic reasons, in the end, didn't include others. I looked at some African jurisdictions and at human rights campaigns there. And in the end, it was things like not having a research assistant who spoke the languages and was able to do research in those jurisdictions for me or be based there in particular. So I did have some really great Argentinian research assistants, and similarly, several of my RAs were from Pakistan and had worked in some of the organizations I was interested in. So those are the contingent reasons. But there was the idea of just looking at different parts of the world. Also, some of it was just based on sort of reading the scholarship. I'm not a practitioner, so I'm less aware of what's actually happening in many parts. So I'm reliant on secondary sources and reports. And some of the things that were happening in these jurisdictions seemed really interesting to me. But the truth is, there could have been many others, many different types of case study. But these are the ones that I chose.
Part of what you looked at in Ireland was in particular the campaign for improving children's rights. And then the one that was probably closest to my heart, because so many of the people that I grew up with and went to university with were so heavily involved in the campaign for reproductive rights more recently in Ireland. We probably don't have time to explore in as much detail as I'd like the cases that you did choose. But in terms of what you found or any themes that arose from looking at the campaign for reproductive rights in Ireland and the extent to which that proved your theory about human rights being a positive force for good. Could you just outline that a little?
So you're right, I picked two. I had initially thought when designing the studies for the book that I'd look at particular human rights instruments and how they were used and whether they helped advance campaigns. And so the Convention on the Rights of the Child is a really obvious one in Ireland, which is a really strong civil society around that. At the same time, I was very aware of how important and interesting the reproductive rights campaign was and how it had energized women across the country. I mean, not only women, but I think primarily women. And you know, that was more difficult because there isn't a strong international human rights law on abortion. There are a myriad different instruments that contribute to supporting the position of women, reproductive health and so on, life, autonomy, privacy. But it was a less neat case study, but in the end, I couldn't resist it. So I thought, I'll look at this. And some people said to me afterwards, but really, was international human rights law so central to the reproductive rights successes and campaigns in Ireland? And what I would say about that is that they played a really interesting role, one more visible to lawyers than to most people, I think, because what most people would say made the difference in Ireland was social mobilization, was your friends and people you were in university with and my nieces and a lot of young people, but not just young people, women who've been campaigning for decades since the really repressive times in the 60s and 70s for women in Ireland. They got together and they actually got onto the streets and they got into the media and so on. But there was also this really interesting interaction engagement that I found between what was going on in international human rights law and the way, not just generally like the European Court of Human Rights coming out with some rulings and the Human Rights Committee of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and CEDAW on discrimination against women and many others, CERD and so on. They all had many, many actors in the international human rights arena had something powerful to say about reproductive rights, particularly in a situation like Ireland, where it was so restrictive, where you had to travel for an abortion, you couldn't get aftercare, even if the fetus was dead, even if your health, your life was at risk. Ireland was at the far end in terms of the restrictions on access to abortion. Several of the women who became prominent, the faces of the campaign, the women whose stories moved people, so that abortion went from being a sort of a taboo and something dreadful, a crime that we should all be ashamed of, to something we could talk about. So when I was in college, I knew that there were some people, friends of mine, relatives that went to England, but we never talked about it. We didn't acknowledge what was happening. It was a source of shame. And I think what changed during the campaign for reform in Ireland was that women were willing to speak out and say, yes, I had an abortion and this is why, and this is what happened to me. But many of those actually had support from some of the advocacy groups and became the names behind some of the cases, you know, Amanda Mellett, Siobhan Whelan, the ABC cases, the X case, all our alphabet of women, as they're called. These actually were both people whose stories moved people, but also their stories were brought to prominence and came back into the public arena because they led to these important rulings, which established new standards or articulated rights and so on at the European level and the international level. And I think the interaction between those was really important, actually, in moving the campaign forward in Ireland.
It's so nice to be reminded about how energized it certainly felt as a campaign to be told about. Obviously, no longer living in Ireland, but I was certainly kept abreast of what was happening. And it was quite an exciting illustration of what a human rights, a grassroots human rights campaign can look like. And I suppose one of the things that I noticed in more recent years is that it is a little bit more fashionable now to be quite skeptical of the human rights movement. It's not necessarily only academics who are raising question marks. And admittedly, there are problems in dealing with some of the bigger global issues in the world, like climate change and gross inequality. But where do you see the future of human rights?
You could say I'm an optimist by nature, and therefore that's why I'm optimistic about the human rights movement. But I don't think it's just that. So if I take the example you just mentioned, climate change, and for many people, they're still having difficulty seeing the relationship between human rights on the one hand and climate change on the other. But there's a huge movement growing around using the international human rights system, which has the things you mentioned at the beginning when you were reading from the preface, a set of institutions, a broad set of often almost universally signed and ratified treaties with basic rights and so on. The climate movement is using those. So if you take Greta Thunberg and her Fridays movement and all the different movements that have emerged out of that, they have used international human rights extensively. They're not cynical, fashionable young people thinking, "Buff, that system failed us." They are using everything at hand, including the human rights system. They're using their feet, they're striking, they're coming to conferences, they're shaming governments and so on, but they're also going to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. They're going to the Human Rights Committee. They're going to special rapporteurs. They're using the instruments and implements, the language, the discourse, the mobilizing potential of human rights. They're not cynical about it. They're angry, but they're motivated. And my sense is that if you think about the Argentina case study in the book, the human rights movement leapt into life in Argentina during the most repressive period of the military dictatorship there. Humans, I think, at fundamentally are committed to their own freedom, welfare, and dignity. So we're all actually believers in human rights if they were deprived of them. And you see that. It's marginalized people. It's people whose rights are not being respected, even in the most repressive and serious situations, that claim them, that assert them, that engage with that language. So that's what gives me hope, is that even though I think the world is in a pretty rocky state at present, that the energy behind women's marches, behind climate campaigns, behind economic justice campaigns, the articulation of rights and the use of that language by communities everywhere, to me, is a sort of a response to David Kennedy's and others' cynicism about, human rights are just an elite tool of the powerful. They have been used as an elite tool of the powerful. At least that language has, and human rights have been used as a pretext for intervention, for warfare, for sanctions and so on. But the idea of reframing that this book is about is bringing the other enormously important dimension in, which is the grassroots dimension, the those whose rights are affected dimension, and they're not cynical.
It's so nice to hear you say all of that, because certainly anyone who listens to this podcast regularly will have heard me harp on about the various ways in which the Human Rights Act in the UK has a positive influence on some of the clients that I and others in my chambers work on behalf of. And I know that you live and teach in the United States, but I wanted to ask you about the human rights consultation currently going on in the UK. I wanted to ask whether or not you think the particular proposals to make it more difficult, for example, to rely on ECHR jurisprudence and the potential introduction of prospective quashing orders are indications of this growing attempt to restrict recourse to human rights, even in so-called Western liberal democracies.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, at one level, as you say, the UK has always had a slightly fraught relationship with European law more generally, European human rights law too, with the ECHR and so on, has always had a slightly more, you know, is very proud of its parliamentary sovereignty and the idea of written bills of rights or intention with that and so on. But and so these new initiatives are not completely out from left field. Nonetheless, first of all, there's some quite radical features in the latest governmental proposals. They are all very much designed to restrict and limit access to rights, and in particular, the use of or drawing on the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. They fit very much with a growing trend internationally of kind of nationalist, populist turn away from the international accountability on the one hand and international human rights institutions in particular. So in the US, Donald Trump had established a commission, the Pompeo Commission it was called. And I was thinking as I was reading some of the critiques of and accounts of the UK government's current proposals that there's some resonance between these two initiatives. The Pompeo Commission was very much about retreat from the whole body of international human rights law that's grown up over the last 30 or 40 years and all its jurisprudence, and a return to a nationalist, you know, so sealing off and getting away from that kind of international influence. And coming back to what some people called an originalist idea of American rights with certain dominant rights like property and other freedoms and so on, and very strong emphasis on religion and the family. So I don't think you see that socially conservative dimension in the UK proposals, you know, with the emphasis on religion, but you definitely see the turn away from the European influence. You know, I don't think anyone would describe the UK Human Rights Act as having brought in any kind of supremacy for the ECHR or sort of hierarchical authority. It was very much a dialogue. It was very much about, with plenty of leeway for UK judges to defer to Parliament when appropriate, or when the language of the statute wouldn't bear construction, and to draw on jurisprudence as appropriate and so on. But it seems as though that's not, you know, enough, that the current government wants to further limit and weaken the potential for Strasbourg jurisprudence to inform the interpretation of by UK judges of the common set of international human rights that are being applied and invoked in cases, to make it harder to invoke those rights. There are other parts of the world where this kind of move to the kind of populist move to exclude international human rights is very much about excluding LGBTQ rights, gender equality, transgender issues, violence against women, rejection of the Istanbul Convention. There's a lot of those moves going on around the world. The UK is not, as far as I can see, engaged in those at all. But there are the minority groups that are clearly disfavored: migrants, prisoners, the deportees, which is a very classic tactic of governments. Pick on the unfavorable groups, the socially disfavored groups, limit their rights further. That's an easy one. It's a populist one. It's a nationalist one. And combining that with the desire to slightly reduce the role of UK courts vis-a-vis Parliament, and then to reduce the role of the Strasbourg court, you know, it's on a spectrum, I think, with more serious attempts to remove independent checks and balances on government. So yeah, I see some worrying trends there, even though they're not entirely out of line with previous conservative moves to limit European human rights law in the UK.
One reason I had for optimism, as was pointed out in a lecture that Lord Carnwath, the recently retired UK Supreme Court judge, gave, and he underlined what he saw was a very positive suggestion in the Independent Human Rights Act review, and that was a introduction of a programme of sort of civic and constitutional education, and whether that might help people understand and perhaps consider human rights with less suspicion. Obviously, it would be easy to be cynical about what might be involved in that sort of program if there is an awful lot of emphasis on responsibilities rather than rights. But I wondered what you thought about that as a recommendation and potentially a tonic to some of the other less positive proposals.
Yeah, I agree that human rights education is incredibly important. It's a little bit like civic or citizen education is really important in building up a sense of civic solidarity and so on. Human rights education could be a really important way of, you know, encouraging people to understand in general the importance of rights and how they're, you know, shared by all, and why commitments to these, this basic idea that all humans are entitled to protection for their equal dignity, their freedom and their welfare, subject to the living in common, the social requirements of compromise and so on. So I do agree with you. I think that's a very it's a very important move. Having said that, in the US anyway, we're going in the opposite direction with all kinds of things being banned now in schools, you know, certain kinds of books and certain kinds of theories of racial injustice and so on are being prohibited in various states of the United States. I just hope that doesn't start to happen in the UK.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about your next project, because you described in an email to me that it's going to focus on illiberal human rights. And I was sort of curious as to what that meant. And I hoped you could tell us a little bit more about that project.
Sure. I mean, the title is meant to be a little bit ironic, the idea of illiberal human rights. You know, what on earth could that mean? But it relates to what I mentioned in the previous conversation we've just had about, I talked about what the Pompeo Commission in the US was doing and what we see happening in, just for example, Poland and Hungary, which are states which are moving very much towards the authoritarian end of the political spectrum. But in addition to that political authoritarianism, we see a kind of what I call a human rights illiberalism, where they're really cracking down on certain kinds of groups and trying to sort of put them outside the remit of rights, whether it's refugees, migrants, LGBTQ communities, trans people and so on, and women quite often, who are hardly a numerical minority, but can often be in status terms. So what I meant by illiberal human rights is that, oddly enough, these different movements, including in the US, Hungary, Poland, Turkey, India, many parts, Brazil, many parts of the world, aren't abandoning the human rights system. So it's not like conservative rejection of rights as a sort of a discourse. No, they're embracing the discourse. They're trying to reshape it. And that's why I call it illiberal human rights, because their emphasis is on the rights of the people, the rights of the family, the rights of the unborn. So some rights are property rights and so on. There's certain rights that are being prioritized and other rights that are, they're attempting to write them out or exclude them from the canon against developments that have taken place in the last 20 or 30 years. So I'm interested, I suppose the title is an ironic one, because it's asking, is this an oxymoron? Is this possible? Could we have an illiberal body of human rights? Just as you hear people asking, Orban claims he has an illiberal democracy. Isn't that an oxymoron? Can you really have a democracy that's illiberal? Because as soon as you look closely, you start to realize that it's undermining the very foundations of what democracy is supposed to be. And I think similarly with human rights, but I'm only just starting to work on that. So
we'll have to watch this space.
Watch this space.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Right. Well, it's been such a pleasure to have you on to talk about your book. I highly recommend Reframing Human Rights in a Turbulent Era to anyone interested in looking into this in more detail. I will include a link to that in the blurb accompanying this podcast, along with the lecture that Lord Carnwath gave recently, because I think it's very much worth listening to. But thank you so much, Grainne. It's been great to have you on.
Thanks very much, Emma. Thank you so much for the plug too, for the book.
LawPod UK is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and produced by One Crown Office Row.